Hi everyone, and happy Friday. Welcome to another day of National Public Health Week. We are going to be talking about reproductive and sexual health. I'm so happy to be joined again with these lovely ladies. I've had both of them on my podcast, so definitely go check those out. I will probably try to link those episodes afterwards so you can check them out and come back to this. But excited once again for a great conversation. And just to get us a little bit of grounding on the conversation, I'm going to be reading the Instagram post I posted this morning or LinkedIn post. So if you have not as yet, be sure to follow me on Instagram at the PH Millennial. So, reproductive and sexual health in public health. Access to quality, accessible reproductive and sexual health care and education leads to healthier lives. Reproductive and sexual health are a central part of health and overall well-being. We must work to combat attacks and discrimination on reproductive health care at the state and local levels, and work to pass policies to protect and promote equitable access to services. Only five states require comprehensive sex education, K through 12. We must promote comprehensive sex education in schools, teach and practice safe sex and pleasurable sex too. We need to destigmatize STIs and promote regular testing. We need to have more conversations around sexual and reproductive justice. We need to respect people's autonomy over their bodies. If you're asking, how can we make a positive impact and destigmatize reproductive and sexual health? How do we have healthier sexual lives? And how do we start these conversations? Well, today on our panel, we're joined by two lovely guests to answer all these questions and more. So we have Dr. Shamika Thorpe and Dr. Megan Williams, and I'll let you all introduce yourselves and tell us how you're showing up today. And before you all introduce yourselves, anyone that's joining, be sure to hit that like button. Be sure to share this with someone who can get some value from this conversation. Really looking forward to hearing more from these guests today.
So hi everyone, I'm Dr. Shamika Thorpe. I'm a sexuality researcher and educator. I'm also an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky in health promotion. How I'm showing up today is I'm just excited to be here. I also feel very creative today, so that's super exciting. And I'm glad to be here and to discuss and have this conversation.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here, Shamika. My name is Dr. Megan Williams. I am a instructional faculty here at Texas A&M. Really interested in access to reproductive health care and in sex education. So hope to bring a little bit of a different space than Shamika, but all good things in a similar realm. I'm showing up a little tired, but I'm so passionate about SRH. Doesn't matter how tired you are, you can find whatever brings you joy, you can find it. So bear with me, but excited to be here today.
Yes, it is a Friday, so we will give everyone grace and we will extend that to anyone listening. But I appreciate you all taking your time on your Friday evening to talk about this. I know it's an important topic to a lot of people, and a lot of people are going to tune in and ask questions. So as I'm saying that, if anyone would like to ask a question, feel free to drop it in the chat and I will ask it to our expert panel as we get time. So to kick things off, I will just want to kind of get like grounding on what is reproductive health? What is sexual health? How do these two teams intersect?
Before we get back to the show, Omari here, founder of the Public Health Millennial. I've started a community and I'd love for you to join. Really wanted to create a space to connect with other public health people, keep up to date with new public health trends and just the latest in the field, a space to ask questions and learn actionable ways to build your professional or personal public health brand. So be sure to join our community. The link is in the description or at thephmillennial.com/join. Prices will go up after National Public Health Week on Monday, the 8th of April. So join today. I look forward to having you and building a stronger public health community together. So join below and now back to the show.
So for me, I think sexual health is more about having access to having safe and pleasurable sex. So I think sometimes pleasure is often left out of sexual health. And so that's the main focus of my research. So I'm always promoting that, but also having access to safe sex as it relates to STIs, but also freedom of sexual coercion. Sexual health also includes sexual functioning. So when we think about arousal, desire, orgasms, pleasure, freedom from sexual pain, all of those things are encompassed there.
Yeah, I think the terms are often used interchangeably, but are actually very different. Like you talked about, pleasure is not in any curricula that I've found other than OWL, which is Our Whole Lives, which is a curricula I was recently trained in. So I'll touch on the reproductive health part, which is more so when and if someone decides they want to have children, how many, at what point in their life, through what method, their kind of contraceptive method, access to their contraceptive method. So very similar, but not so much about the pleasure, but should include pleasure, but often doesn't. I think they're, again, used synonymously, but not quite. So, just like sexuality, I think often is kind of taken down just to STI prevention methods and contraception, when it's actually much broader when you talk about sexuality, also including sexual orientation, gender identity, anatomy and physiology, sexual violence prevention, consent, communication. So, even expanding sexual health to one part of the, term that would fall under the umbrella of sexuality.
And why should we, to preface the question, I feel like growing up, we were not taught a lot about sex education, or there could have been more comprehensive sex education out there. And I think going a step further is the sexuality education. And I think like the framing came from the conversation that I had with Megan on the podcast. It is like there's so much more than just sex in sex education. So how did we come to this point where it is broader than that, and why is that important?
Well, unfortunately, I think for a lot of places, it's not broader than that. I think for many, especially in the K-12 space, they're getting the bare minimum of anatomy and physiology. And sometimes the reproductive, like, organs are being taken out of those spaces even. So they're getting, we're happy for any education on the body at all. But wishing that it could be more comprehensive, because relationships are a part of life. Sex is a part of life. Intimacy is part of life. Consent is a part of everyday life. Can I borrow your pencil? Can I drive your car? Right? It doesn't have to do with just intimate partners and friendships, right? So I think changing the narrative and trying to find ways to bring sexuality education to other spaces and other disciplines could be one way to help.
Yeah, and I think building on what Megan said, I'm even thinking about sex ed and how it used to encompass like sexual orientation and sexual identity and gender identity. And in many states, we can't talk about those things anymore. And so that's definitely not as comprehensive as it has been when I first started teaching sex ed. So that's definitely a barrier. But I think we've gotten to it being in this broader space because we've been lucky enough to have sexuality educators that have created these comprehensive sex ed curriculums. And in some states, the laws differ. So some states have laws around who can teach comprehensive sex ed, and sometimes it's county specific. So I know sometimes in North Carolina, some counties do some certain things and others don't. So it just varies. So just being aware of like what people are able to do in each county, each district, what laws have been passed, I think is extremely important.
And I just want to lift up the point that Elizabeth made in the chat. I wish consent was a part of everyday life. It seems to be disappearing, and people really don't seem to teach it to their kids young. Gender identity and LGBTQ plus issues should be part of sex education because cultural competency. And I think to the broader question, we all here live in the South, and we know that there have been a lot of challenges in the South around reproductive health, around how we speak about certain topics. How have you all moved to maneuver within the system that we do live in to really ensure that you are doing your best job of creating space for those kind of conversations?
Just try to normalize it. I don't know. I teach human sexuality at the college level, and often they come to my class very nervous and very not wanting to upset people, and coming from the space of stigma and feeling really uncomfortable, and just trying to make it a we're here because we care about each other and we care about how we talk about each other. And so, how can we have conversations and normalize saying the word abortion, saying the word penis, like any of these? They're just normal words that are a part of our everyday vocabulary, and we're not inherently taught that. Like, abortion is bad, right? There's values that are placed on that, and there's values that are placed on the word penis and vagina, right? And so we learn uncomfortability. We're helping people retrain their brains and retrain their conversations, and encouraging them to be, I say, good sexual citizens, like the book talks about, and just talking about subjects in everyday life that doesn't have to be very weird or uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think building off what Megan just said, one thing you with teaching undergraduate students, so I teach sexuality education at the undergrad level, and I always have them do a sexual values assessment where they have to write about like certain things that have impacted their sexuality. So like when I start the class on the first week, I have like this, it's not a mood board, I don't know what you call it, but it's all these different pictures, a collage of things that made me the sexual being that I am. And so I offer them like time to reflect on that. And I think when they do that, they can see that a lot of times the things that have shaped them have been external influences and not their own. And so I hope that through class, they're able to figure out like, hey, this is actually what I believe, right? Like not what other people have told me. I think when it comes to high schools or maybe middle schools, I think with high schools is you can have some conversations. And I think sometimes you can kind of gauge what students like were asked certain questions, and it's like safe to answer that question, right? And no one will run home and tell their parent. So I think sometimes it's like asking for permission later, but answering students' questions. Like if they have a question, I'm going to answer it. So I'm not the person to have in the spaces that, have these restrictions.
Love
Yeah,
that.
some people believe this, other people believe this. What do you believe? And then maybe leave it a little bit more open-ended. Or doing like values, instead of asking about them, just in general, some values around these particular topics or behaviors could be this. You can maybe think about what yours would be. And so kind of beating around the bush a little bit, but still helping them understand their values.
That's important. This is a conversation about like self-reflection in so many ways. I think the answer to so many things, or like just understanding ourselves, is in that self-reflection, really understanding what are the things that we value, what are the things that society has put on us to value, and like are those things that are intersecting, are those things that like really save us, and just really figuring that out. And I think that's an important practice to do in sexual and reproductive health, as well as in life in general. So I'm glad that you brought that up, as well as like being strong in just knowing that you have to share this information and it has to get out there one way or another. So there's quite a few different things going on in the chat here. So there's a question around, do you also cover women's reproductive health, for example, menstrual cycle issues? And I guess before I get to that question, Elizabeth also raised up the point that sex education is taboo in the South here because of religious overtones and everything. Of course, we are sending our children to college feeling uncomfortable. I'm so afraid it's only going to get worse as laws progressively become more restrictive to women's reproductive issues and LGBTQ plus issues in our area. And toxic alpha male culture encourages men to not accept rejection. A lot of the, I feel like that could be an entire podcast in itself. But going back to the question that Renee posed around, do you also cover women's reproductive health, for example, menstrual cycle issues?
Yeah, so
Sure.
in some sex ed programs we do, I know within sexuality education, like in the undergraduate level, I definitely talk about that. I think a lot of times, like what I've seen in research is that oftentimes when people, parents are actually providing sexual communication, especially to their daughters, it's oftentimes around menstrual education. And so that's when they start talking about sex ed, is because of that. And so I think there's opportunities to do more parent-child sexuality education and having curriculums that focus on that. But yeah, I definitely cover that in class because it's a part of reproductive health and sexual health.
Yeah, and we do too in my sexuality class, and we have a women's health class that covers it as well. And we talk a lot of some things that came to mind were like menstrual related coercion, or reproductive coercion that includes menstruation or menstruation products, menstruation poverty. So it's not just the basic like yes, here are some menstruation issues, but also like period poverty and what period poverty looks like across the world and why people of all genders menstruate, right? It's not just somebody who identify, not just people who have who are born as women, right? Like this is a problem for everyone, right? You should be able to go up to any teacher and say, "Hey, I need to use the bathroom because I am menstruating. I'm going to like it's not. I think we lump it into this category if it's taboo, but it's something that is natural, cannot be changed or modified. It's a natural part of the body, and so I wish there wasn't so much stigma. But yeah, we definitely talk about that. They get to figure out how a tampon is inserted and other menstrual discs. And for the first time, this could be the first time for many that they've ever seen a tampon or a menstrual disc or a menstrual cup. We talk about period pain. It's like all of these, and also gender expansive menstruation products, right? So things that don't involve insertion or how to get it for free and things like that. But I wish it was more common in the K-12 space where states like Florida are banning discussions around menstruation. But I echo Shamika's discussion around the idea of puberty and that beginning the conversation around puberty that relates to menstruation, that leads to relationships, that leads to sex. So it can be a great space for educators and parents to begin the conversation around relationships, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciate that insight. And if you are here, be sure to hit that like button, share it with a friend. Great conversation, great insights. And Renee is glad that you shared what you did share. She said, I find that a lot of women still suffer and it still is very much taboo. And I believe she is calling in from Barbados as well. And I guess an undertone of the conversation and some of the things that you alluded to before was around stigma. So, how can we address stigma and promote comprehensive reproductive and sexual health education that empowers individuals to make informed decisions about their health and well-being?
I think some of the stigma, especially related to STIs, is a result of.
Before we get back to the show, Omari here, founder of the Public at Millennial. I've started a community and I'd love for you to join. Really wanted to create a space to connect with other public health people, keep up to date with new public health trends and just the latest in the field, a space to ask questions and learn actionable ways to build your professional or personal public health brand. So be sure to join our community. The link is in the description or at thephmillennial.com/join. Prices will go up after National Public Health Week on Monday, the 8th of April. So join today. I look forward to having you and building a stronger public health community together. So join below, and now back to the show.
Abstinence-only education. And so feeling like you don't have the tools to communicate to your partners or know what your needs are, feel comfortable exploring what your sexual needs and desires are. I think also I'm thinking back to my own like sex ed experience and being taught by a gym teacher and them showing us like those scary worst case scenario STI pictures. And so if that's what you think an STI looks like, one, then you may never think you have one, but people should get tested because a lot of times people are asymptomatic. But also, it's like going to be this stigma because if that's what everyone has seen, then it's like, oh, well, that's what you have. And that's not what it always looks like. And so I think some of that is just, combating abstinence-only education, dispelling myths around what STIs look like, making people aware that most things can be asymptomatic. I think also removing some of the religious shame. So I think that goes back to our values that we were talking about, especially I see that a lot when I'm working with girls of color that they are often carrying a lot of religious shame or anybody that was raised in like purity culture. And that definitely creates a lot of stigma for them. And so some of that is just having the expansiveness to think about like what do you believe outside of what other people have told you? And I think sometimes that's scary for people.
Yeah, snaps to all of the things you said. The other thing I kind of think about is these like values we've placed on certain things, right? Like the language we use around having an STI, especially non-curable ones such as HIV or HPV, which are treated across the lifespan, and the societal stigma that comes with it, right? People don't really get to make up their own values about it because they're told what they are once they have it. The other thing I thought about was fear. I think a lot of stigma is just fear of what people will think about me or being nervous or being outcasted and things like that, which is on purpose, right? Like we don't, what do they say? Knowledge is power, right? And so if we don't inform people, if we don't give them the tools to know differently, we can't be surprised when they fall in those categories. So I think the biggest one is comprehensive sex education that is medically accurate, age appropriate, culturally appropriate, taught by somebody who is educated and passionate about it and represents the people that we're teaching, right? We need a diverse set of educators that are going into communities that look like the people we're teaching to help them understand culturally appropriate ways to learn this information that are relevant. We have to start with comprehensive sex ed and we can continue from there. The other thing I think about is misinformation online. Ooh, a lot is happening. I think about Opill and just a lot of misinformation around the difference between medication abortion and emergency contraception, right? And the stigma around abortion in general. And so I think it can all just kind of get lumped into there. And without people to combat the misinformation, you start to have stigma and nobody to discredit it or say it's false.
And I guess maybe this is a leading question. Are there places on the internet that you would lead people to get more accurate information, whether that is around sexual health or reproductive health?
Yeah, so I think if they want like resources and people to follow, the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists has a list of certified educators, counselors, and therapists. There's also the Women of Color Sexual Health Network. And so that is a list of any type of sexuality professional you may be interested in, their state that they currently live in, and the work that they do. Also, I think for people that may be parents or guardians, checking out Sex Positive Families, they always have great resources for people that are caretakers of little ones, even if you're an aunt, like that's important. So I go there for a lot of resources and they provide a lot of information about how to talk to young children. So I would say like elementary school age about some of these myths that Megan was bringing up, or even how to have education around, pornography, like that's important. How to talk about consent, how to talk about gender identity. And so that's a great resource that I always refer parents or caregivers to.
Those were good. I hadn't heard of a couple of those. I'm going to jot those down. The first one that came to mind with me was Bedsider, which is a comprehensive tool that compares contraceptive methods, cost, insertion, time of recovery, how long it lasts. And then Ask Rue is a Planned Parenthood chatbot that you can text into if you have questions about reproductive or sexual health. And it's answered by a health educator. It can be a volunteer or it can be a professional, and they'll answer anything from contraception to abortion to relationships to consent, and they'll connect you with the resources that you need. I know Debbie Herbinick just also wrote a book about the communication between parents and children regarding sexuality. I can't think of, I know, Izzy, you're shaking your head, Shamika. I can't think about what its name is, but I've heard really good things. It's all about communication tools for parents talking about sexuality topics, so would recommend that too.
Thank you for sharing those resources. I will try to capture that and reshare it at some point in time. But definitely helpful for a lot of people out there that are trying to have these conversations. And as I said before, if you're listening to this, watching this, be sure to hit that like button and feel free to drop your question in the chat. So pivoting a little bit and shifting to access to reproductive health care, what policy measures and advocacy efforts are needed to protect and expand access to reproductive health care services, including contraception, abortion, and LGBTQ plus health care in the face of increasing legislative challenges?
Well, that's a loaded question. We need more time. I guess what I think about is insurance access. I think that's one of the biggest structural barriers we have to any healthcare measure, not just repro health, but diabetes care and insulin. Like anything you can think of starts with the gatekeeper or, that. So, everyone should have access to healthcare in general, right? But also especially our marginalized populations are those that might be the least likely to access repro care. And it has to be, access has many different, so I think about it like an umbrella term, right? Access could mean financial, access could mean transportation, access could mean health literacy. So the insurance is the first part, and then extended on that is then policies that help people to navigate the healthcare system. And I don't know if that's a policy, but thinking of Medicaid, including abortion, right? So the Hyde Amendment, all these things that prevent that. I'm going to come back to, maybe Shamika will help me think of other things, but I think of insurance and then access to navigating the healthcare system and lack of discrimination within the healthcare system for low health literacy or racism or discrimination and other things like that.
And I think some of the things that you're mentioning that we need within healthcare, those policies have to change within like medical schools. And so making sure that they have access to sexual health like courses and curriculums beyond the amount of hours that they get, I think is important. I think also right now we have a lot of medical places and medical centers that say that like they're LGBTQ friendly, but what queer person like walked in and said, yes, you really are, right? So like have like so having something that is made by the people that have those identities that say, yes, this actually is LGBTQ friendly, or it is queer affirming, I'm doing a project right now on same-sex couples that are using assisted reproductive technologies. Is this fertility clinic affirming or not, right? Like, so making sure that people can have those spaces. And then one thing that I thought about recently, because a student in my class brought it up, was like this freedom to use period tracking apps and fertility tracking apps. And we were discussing how people don't necessarily do that anymore because people are using it to track if possibly you've had an abortion or not. Since they did all these things with like Roe versus Wade, they were now tracking period gaps. And if they see a gap or some changes in your period, then they're like, oh, it's likely this person may have had an abortion or they were pregnant and they're no longer pregnant. And so that's something that I think a policy that needs to change as far as like data sharing around that.
Yeah. Comprehensive sex ed at the K-12 level, starting literally in kindergarten. And that, there needs to be policies not around just the education, but who's teaching it, right? So we need certified sexuality educators, or at minimum health educators with an interest in sexuality, so that it is coming from somebody who's passionate and informed. There was another one I was thinking of. The period tracking apps is a sad one, and not feeling comfortable. Luckily, we do have some sort of idea around affirming providers, but in rural areas, the possibility of affirming providers just decreases so much. I've been excited to hear about expansion of Medicaid for postpartum care, which has been great, past the 6 weeks, which is absolutely negligible. So excited to see that. I think parental leave would be good, not just maternity leave, but paternity leave or parental leave in general. When we think about maternal mortality rates, I know we're talking about repro health, but one part of repro health is pregnancy. And so thinking about the idea of somebody giving birth and then 6 weeks just happening to go back to their life seems very overwhelming and not a good measure for the baby or for mom and the other partner. So having minimum 6 months, probably more like a year of paid parental leave, which is standard across many other nations and somehow seems to slip through the cracks here in the US, I think would help decrease some of the burdens around childbearing here in the US. And paid parental leave, not just parental leave because we won't fire you, but paid parental leave with insurance and all the benefits. One of the other things I think is access to reproductive health care that's not age restricted. So like OPIL, the new over-the-counter birth control, does not have an age requirement, as it shouldn't be. And so not accessing or not restricting use of contraceptive methods by age. In Texas, you need parental consent to get hormonal birth control. That's a problem if there's sexual assault within the family and that person, the assailant, is the parent, right? Like that automatically creates systemic barriers to access to care. So allowing young people to make informed decisions, but decisions about their own bodies, I think could go a long way too.
Clearly, there is a lot that needs to be done, and there's a lot of, I think, a lot of opportunity to get these kind of things done and really create healthier communities, more access to things that are supportive of families. And I think I really appreciate you lifting up the parental leave and the 6 months parental leave. And some of the themes that are going on in chat is around rural communities. And just as you mentioned it, it's like they have maybe like a double challenge in this. And many times, especially in this part of the country, those rural communities are very religious communities. And then that leads to all the other barriers that we kind of spoke to. So I guess, like, before we move on, are there any specific things that you all will talk to advocate in rural communities as opposed to urban communities, if you all have experience in that?
All communities face their own challenges. I'm not going to try to be an expert in this person's life or their needs to care. I did a little bit of work in Rural County in Alabama where I was last, and the lack of, like, we don't have a Title IX clinic here in College Station. There is no family planning clinic here in our town. So that means our students and community members drive well over an hour to care. And we're not rural by any means, but we're not urban. So I think finding ways to bring access to people through the mail, right, is one way to do that. Abortion pills, contraception, things like that could be easy. Texas wears condoms, provides free condoms and dental dams and lube and HIV tests, but knowledge is what we need to get that there. And if, what if they don't have access to the internet? What if they don't have a mailbox? What if they're unhoused? house and they don't have a place to mail things to, right? So it's like all these systemic barriers. But I would just say, you know, grassroots organizations are out there. You just kind of have to locate them and think smart about how we can go around it. Yeah, I'll turn it over to Shamika. Maybe she has some other
Yeah.
ideas.
So I'm from a rural community, like to the point that we could probably only get condoms at a gas station and at our local grocery store. We have one grocery store. We probably had three doctors total within 20 minutes, like a 20-minute radius. And so what I've noticed with doing work in rural communities is that oftentimes we would just, it's just trying to provide like condoms and information about sex ed. And so a lot of times we did that through community health fairs that surprisingly were at churches. And so it addresses the point of like, you know, having church buy-in and the importance of that, if that is very important within the South. But then also, I think in every rural community that I've been a part of or been to, there's always one sex positive elder in that community. And so when you find that person, like hold on to them for dear life and like help me, help me. And they're always willing to help. But I think, you know, we can't make judgments that like everyone within rural communities are like sex negative because they're not. So finding those people that are sex positive, reaching out for them to them for support and organizing with them is what has been helpful and what I've seen as helpful for other people that work in rural counties, especially within North Carolina. That's what I've seen.
Yeah, I'm from North Carolina and I went to East Carolina. One of the big missions of our medical school was to train providers to work in rural areas in primary care. And so I think thinking about residency positions and you don't see sexual health, like we have OBs, we have maternal health, but primary care physicians see STIs, they see HPV, they see contraceptives and stuff. So I think making sure that we keep in mind that we're the people that we're training need to be incentivized to work in rural areas where there is such a need. I wish I could get that to our lawmakers, but encouraging, you know, putting, bringing services to people and meet them where they are.
And more broadly speaking, how can we use advocacy efforts? How can we strengthen the advocacy efforts that are already out there to promote this equitable access to reproductive health care and to work to combat some of those systemic barriers we spoke about?
I think part of it is also like funding. So I'm thinking about like organizations and people that I know that are on the grounds doing this work, advocacy work day in and day out. Like they just don't have the funding they need to support the work that they want to do. And so I think advocating for them to have more funding, whether it be nonprofits or grassroots organizations. I'm also thinking about doulas and reproductive health. Like doulas do not get paid enough money, especially Black women doulas. So Black women and femme doulas do not get paid enough. So they definitely need more money. People need access to doulas for free if they want them. So, you know, I think making sure that there's funding resources that are going to the people that are already doing the work. And on top of that, I think we have to realize that advocacy is hard work and can take a toll on people's mental health. And so having counseling resources also for people that are on the grounds doing this work day in and day out.
Yeah, I wish it was taught a little bit more in school. I was reflecting on my own educational journey and a lack of access, lack of class specifically on advocacy around public health in general. Like I took public health communications classes, and within that, you make like educational materials and such. But I get asked all the time, I want to advocate. I want to go, you know, to the Hill. I want to go to my legislators. And I'm like, okay, yeah, like how can I make this happen? But I think there's a really exciting young network of people who are excited and they're mad and they're upset. And so I think encouraging our next generation of folk who are so passionate to tap into local organizations that are doing the work that are already advocating. When I was at Alabama, I took some students to Advocacy Day through Urge and through the Alabama Campaign for Adolescent Sexual Health and to some other organizations who do training. So they taught us how to, we had a whole script. They trained us how to talk to these legislators. Of course, it didn't go like it was supposed to when we were sitting down with this senator, but it's okay. We tried. And so tap into your local orgs, like Shamika was talking about, that are doing the good fight, and see if you can tap into them or suggest, hey, we have young people or anyone who's interested in this. We want to learn more. I think advocacy can also be on the small side, just reposting things that are factual and bringing to light educators and researchers who are doing work in repro health and advocating for the work that they do. Supporting voting is one of the biggest ways we can advocate and require, understanding what you're voting for and who you're voting for can be really challenging. I mean, I still struggle with it too. I'm like, okay, people in my area, and this is their name, and I don't know, they're in this thing, and what do they vote for? And so, trying to make information around voting easier and just encouraging people to stand up in their everyday lives. It doesn't have to be this huge monumental thing, but small little victories every day that can kind of build to bigger futures and better things.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. And in that same vein, and I know that you kind of spoke to it already, but how can we specifically focus and engage youth in doing this type of advocacy work that's so important?
I think of Advocates for Youth, and that's what kind of first comes to mind is their Youth Activist Network, which actually I think has a call out right now. So they're a really awesome org for young people. I don't know much about it. I didn't know I liked sexual health until I was in college, so I didn't get to be part of it. But it seems really great. They train them in advocacy. They're involved in programs. The Yellowhammer Fund in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, also has a youth advocacy network. The Alabama Campaign for Adolescent Sexual Health has a youth like board, and so I feel like there's an increase and there's a push for elevating youth voices within a lot of repro networks because they are our next generation. So tapping into those local resources or starting them, if you're interested and you are a youth, there doesn't have to be a path for you to forge your own. So expressing interest and saying, how do I get involved, even if it's coming to meetings or running your social media or whatever that might be.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have anything to add. I think I've seen some like advocacy summer camps. And so with summer quickly approaching, that would be a great opportunity for youth as well. But I think Megan has said most of the things.
They do Sex Ed on the Hill, which I don't think there's an age restriction for. I really want to go to it, actually. It's supposed to be in DC. It sounds super fun. I haven't been able to go. And then the Advocacy Summit is hosted by SOFI every fall in October. So not necessarily repro health specific, but advocacy specific. And so that might be a good way to get some general advocacy tools, and then you can tailor them specifically to repro health.
And changing, I guess, direction a little bit. Most of my audience are young professionals or students for the most part. What kind of advice do you have for them if they're trying to enter into this reproductive and sexual health world, like the intersection of like working in that and public health?
I always tell people to like look at people's CVs and see how they got to where they were, right? Like most of the time, if people are in academics, like their CVs are posted somewhere, so you can look at that and see like, hey, this is the path they took. I think a lot of times people feel like they have to get a degree in human sexuality or some type of, sexuality studies graduate certificate. And yes, that might be helpful, but most people I know do not have a degree in human sexuality that do this type of work. So being mindful of what you want to do and in what ways, right? So there's some people that are focused on sexual health and they're epidemiologists. There's other people that only thing that they do is health policy, right? And so just being mindful of what you like to do, what fuels you, what are you passionate about, I think is extremely helpful. And then also just finding those mentors throughout your life that can help you navigate, the systems to get to the career that you want to have.
Yeah, I learned the trick of looking at CVs or resumes and kind of sticking along their path. If they were successful, you probably can be too. This is a shameless plug, but I started an org specifically for this for up and coming early career and young professionals in repro health called YPSRH. You can check us out on Instagram or LinkedIn. Basically, just a big network of people kind of starting out their careers, interested in learning more about jobs and networking and internships, funding. Policy initiatives, just looking for friends or whoever in the field. So that's a shameless plug. The other thing I would say, at least until July, repro jobs, posts jobs around reproductive health, and so does ASECT. They have a job board, and you can look at it by early career professional or BS or the type of degree. And so there are jobs for early career and people out of their master's or no degree at all. So don't let your credentials stop you from getting in the field, especially at the health department level and the hospital level. Like you can be a health educator, you can be trained in curricula. You just got to get in the door. It doesn't matter how. So don't let the fear of the credentials or the alphabet soup prevent you from doing what you really want to do. And if at any time you need help from me, I'm here. I think Shamika might say the same too. Most of us in the repro world are pretty helpful and kind and want to see everyone succeed. And we probably had mentors that paved the path for us. So don't be afraid to reach out, even if it's just a quick call. Put your name on the radar. We're here to help.
And directly this question to Shamika. So you are a founder or co-founder, I can't remember
Founder,
which founder of the
co-founder.
co-founder of the Minority Sex Report, where you have a mission to provide representation of Black and Native American people within sexuality education. Can you talk about the importance of that and kind of about the work that you all are doing?
Yeah, so growing up in rural North Carolina, myself and Dr. Gabrielle Evans decided, hey, we didn't receive the type of comprehensive sex ed that we wanted and that we deserved and that our communities deserve. And so we decided to create the Minority Sex Report. We started out with doing a lot of community health education within, the churches that I spoke about earlier, but also school systems. And now we have advanced to doing more research on the organizational level or more work on an organizational level. So we provide trainings around reproductive justice, how to make sure that the case management as well as the programs that you're doing are sex positive, as well as offering book clubs. And so that's been super fun doing reproductive justice book clubs with different organizations. And so we just want to make sure that people that are coming up behind us that are Black, that are Native American can see themselves in the work and can see themselves and see, that people care about them.
Love that a lot. And from the book club, and I guess from the life in this world, both of you, are there any books that you suggest people read to get more acquainted with reproductive or and sexual health?
Yeah, so on my website, drshamika.com, I have a list of books that are around Black sexuality, reproductive justice, pleasure. I'm not sure what else, but there's a long list. So I would suggest that people look at that. I think off the top of my head, I would encourage people to read the book Medical Bondage, as well as the book Medical Apartheid. And I'm looking over at my bookshelf because there's one more that I'm missing. But those two are off the top of my head. I think another book that I also want to recommend is Invisible Families. And so that book is about Black lesbian couples that are mothering and raising children. What is that like for them? The process of actually conceiving children. And so I think that that's often a population that is missing from the work around reproductive justice and LGBTQ health.
Yeah, there's so many. We could have so many book clubs. I think about Come As You Are, Emily Nagoski. I hope I'm saying her name right, but basically about all about reproductive or pleasure for people with female bodies and the sexual response cycle and a lot of these structural barriers that we encounter. The other one is the Vagina Bible, which is kind of like an anatomy guide or questions around like menstruation or contraception or breast health, anything like that. The Turnaway Study is one that's been on my mind, related to turning away folks from abortion and what happens when we do that. Oh my gosh, there's so many. I've been listening to Repro's Fight Back. I know it's not a pop book, but it's a podcast that I really enjoy. I got my first anatomical guidebook with Black bodies in the fall, and it was fabulous. And I show it to my students, and there need to be more representations of people of color in medical anatomy books in general. So not necessary. It's like a workbook, and it's fabulous. I wish I could get more copies. But not a, it should be a plug. It was recently created and put out. I got it at the Sex Ed Con.
Love it, love it. Lots of books and things that people can dive into to get a lot more research and understanding. And as I said earlier, I'd be sure to like to share this with someone. And if you have any questions, we do have more time for questions. So definitely drop those in chat if you have anything that's interesting. So I wanted to shift back to the pleasure part of things because I think that's important and oftentimes missed. Come as you Are is one of the books that I read, I don't know, maybe like 5 years ago. More recently, I've read this book called Slow Sex. Can't remember who it's by, but I think like the idea, I think it's an important topic to talk about and not spoken about enough. So I'm going to give you all the floor to talk more about like why that's important, or like maybe some of the historical context of why we didn't talk about it and why it's important to talk about it now.
I think we didn't talk about it because we weren't able to, right? So just thinking about the policies that prevent people from talking about anything sex positive have existed for a long time. And so people haven't had the opportunity to discuss that, especially as it relates to like Black bodies and pleasure. And so I think, there's been research that has been done previously with like Dr. Kinsey, and that has been mostly with like white people and their pleasure, but Black people have been omitted from that. And so I think pleasure is important because most of the time when we see people's motivations for having sex, it is around having sexual pleasure or like tension release or stress release. And so if people are having sex for pleasure but don't know what brings them pleasure or how to figure out what might bring them pleasure, do not feel comfortable exploring that due to shame, that can be an issue. I think also in my own work, I've seen that there's some normalization around like sexual pain, and that pain is, that sex is supposed to be painful. And so that is something that we can talk about in comprehensive sex ed, but we can't talk about that in abstinence-only sex ed. And so I think for me, some of my work is around, focusing on sexual pain disorders or sexual pain symptomology, and how can we end that so people can have pleasure-filled sex. Even thinking about like Halle Berry was just in the news recently talking about being perimenopausal and how she went to the doctor because she said she felt like she had like razor blades in her vagina, and the doctor didn't even know how to treat her and diagnosed her with like the worst case of herpes he had ever seen in his life, but didn't test her for herpes or anything. That just said that's what it was, and it turns out she was going through perimenopause. And so we see that doctors aren't even educated around, what menopause looks like, perimenopause, sexual difficulties. And so that's why this work is important, because if the World Health Organization is saying sexual health includes pleasure, well, we need to focus on pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not because we don't want to, it's because we're not allowed to. I think the discussion of pleasure assumes that sex is a good thing, and we're not quite there yet as a society. Maybe us in this room and us on the call would potentially agree, but our lawmakers potentially aren't quite on the same page, and there's some kind of non-activists or people not exactly excited about the idea of sex being enjoyable, because then young people are going to want to do it, and we're not ready to accept that yet. But I think, like Shamika talked about, the idea of sex that's not pleasurable is just sad. It just make it that's not what it's supposed to be like, right? When very few people are having sex for the idea of reproduction. It should be pleasurable, and it should be pleasurable for everyone involved, not just one person. And so I'm excited that Shamika's work includes ideas around pleasure and normalizing mutual pleasure for all involved, and discussions around self-pleasure, not just the other person, but yourself. And then that could bring you joy, and it can be helpful in reducing illness and pain and headaches and migraines. And it's the safest form of sexual play. Like, it doesn't have any health indications. You're not going to transmit an STI to yourself. Like, it's the safest form of pleasure. And so normalizing that and continuing to talk about it. And I think integrating pleasure in general can help maybe a little bit with that, not just within sex, but throughout our life, like going to walk in a field or going outside and smelling things, and kind of heightening our sensations throughout the day can make us more sexual beings. And so then when we're in intimate relationships or even in casual encounters, we can have an understanding of what brings us pleasure and translate that into sexual activity. So maybe bridging the gap there a little bit.
Love it, love it. And I think that this is an important conversation, and I'm glad that you all raised that up. And there are Many Resources Like Come As You Are. I think that was a great book. Really opened up my eyes to a lot of different things. And that's a conversation for another kind of podcast. But this conversation has been very helpful. And Renee in the chat has said like perimenopause discussions are very much needed. And apparently it's something that maybe she's seeing also, that like we aren't discussing that and it's not a part of the broader conversation. Do you all want to share more about that before I move on to the last question?
I just want to shout out Black Girl's Guide to Menopause and all the work that Omi is doing around that to kind of remove the taboo and the silence around talking about menopause within the Black community. I know for some people, they may not have elders that they can talk to about menopause. I know for me, I only have one family member that went through natural menopause. Most women in my family had hysterectomies. So having those resources, is extremely important. So just shout out to Omi and Black Girl's Guide to Menopause.
Not an expert in perimenopause, so I'm going to leave Shamika. She's the expert. I'll leave her to her expertise.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you sharing that as well. So the second to last question that I will ask before wrapping this up, unless someone has another question, is kind of going back to the advocacy and the broader conversations that we need to have. So how can we start to have conversations with lawmakers to really not only help, well, I guess help them combat the stigma and the discrimination around reproductive health, healthcare, and ensure inclusive care practices for all communities.
Before we get back to the show, Omari here, founder of the Public at Millennial. I've started a community and I'd love for you to join. Really wanted to create a space to connect with other public health people, keep up to date with new public health trends and just the latest in the field, a space to ask questions and learn actionable ways to build your professional or personal public health brand. So be sure to join our community. The link is in the description or at thephmillennial.com/join. Prices will go up after National Public Health Week on Monday, the 8th of April. So join today. I look forward to having you and building a stronger public health community together. So join below. And now back to the show.
This is a $1 million question. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if we know. I think part of that is because you have to have lawmakers that care, right? And the ones that care, it's easier to have those conversations with them. We can tell the stories about, reproductive health or people that didn't have access to certain things or people that didn't have access to safe abortions. But people have to care. I think another thing is for those that don't care, you have to talk dollars and you have to talk like stats. So having stats to back up what you're saying and having like figures and money like is important to bring up in those conversations. So just I think being mindful of what you're presenting to them. I think if we knew the ways to do it, right, like it would be done. But I think it every time, every year, it feels like trial and error, depending on who is elected. And so just being mindful of who you're talking to.
I would say the same thing. I think starting at the local level, I think we often assume the federal level is really where change is at. And yeah, probably, but the people that impact us the most are these state laws, these banning of books across the states, across our local school board, things like that, sex ed in schools. That's kind of where we start. So thinking about how to get involved there and how to make change in the maybe run for office, I don't know. But getting to know who your local representatives are. And I think about, yeah, health outcomes, like how can, what are the factors and the variables that our politicians are really gonna care about. In our training, we talked a lot about stories and storytelling and how can we really weave a narrative. You can't change someone's I think hearing a story of a personal account of what happened or why this topic is important to you can be really impactful, especially if the person cares, like Shamika said. Otherwise, those dollars talk. So maybe emphasizing those, and I think we try to move mountains, but start with the trailhead and gradually climb. And progress is progress, no matter how big or small. And don't get defeated when it doesn't go your way. Keep going, and you're doing good work, even if it doesn't get you to the result you want.
Yeah, absolutely. All wins don't seem like wins, but many times a win could even be a conversation around this topic with a lawmaker. And I think we have to acknowledge that those are small wins on the path to bigger wins. And I think the bigger conversation is how do we get lawmakers, people that actually represent the people that want to see change? And I think that's a bigger conversation we need to have as a society, in public health, just generally speaking. But I think that is very important. So I appreciate you all sharing that. So are there any maybe last sentences or last takeaways that you want to share with people around the National Public Health Week topic of reproductive and sexual health?
I think about sexual health being integrated into every access and area of health. We often think about, the silos, physical health, mental health, physical health, all those things. But I think sexual health is really integrated into everything, right? It adds into our mental health, it adds into our financial health, it adds into our physical fitness, right? And so thinking about how do we integrate this into our everyday lives. It doesn't have to be this one-time thing. It's relationships, it's communication, it's consent, it's anatomy, it's all these things. And so trying to integrate it more as much as you can and not make it one particular siloed taboo thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Recently, I've been having more conversations about like spiritual health and sexual health. And so that's been interesting to see. So I definitely appreciate you bringing that up. I think I would just encourage people to like read the book. So even read and come as you are, I think is important. But there's a workbook, right? So like for every book Emily Nagoski makes, there's a workbook. And so I encourage people to get the workbooks and kind of, take that moment to just journal and figure out, what is important to you and just being mindful of that and having resources, whether it's books, workbooks, people you want to talk to, going to these free conferences that may exist, applying for scholarships for conferences that are not free. And then also shameless plug, my mentor is putting out a book, Dr. Candace Hargons, called Good Sex. And I'm super excited to read it. And I hope you all will purchase it. And I'm going to add it to my book list when it comes out.
Love it, love it. And yeah, be sure to share that with me, and I will share it out somewhere, somehow, to someone as a resource. But thank you all so much for this wonderful, inspiring, enlightening, informative, timely conversation. Before we head out of here, I did want to quickly just go over like favorites. Was there anything exciting that you've seen within the last week, 2 weeks? It could be a movie, article, podcast, something random.
Yeah. So for me, over the last week, I have attended two Black women's writers workshops, and that has been extremely fun. So last night, I actually was it last night? Was it a Friday? Wednesday night, I actually got to see Nikki Finney and Crystal Wilkinson talk about Crystal's new book, but also their friendship and sisterhood in writing and what it means to be poets and writers. And so that was just very like warm and loving for me. And it felt like it encouraged me and empowered me. And I think I feel more creative than I've ever felt this semester.
Mine's not academic, but I've been binging Suits, which makes me now think I could be a lawyer. So, but other than that, just really encouraged by the passion that I find my students have for some of the areas within SRH that I also care about. And so it's great to see that they are picking up some individual things within SRH and are making the world a better place.
Well, I appreciate you all coming on today, Shamika and Megan. It has been an interesting conversation, and I think it is the beginning of a lot of other conversations that need to be had. But I really, really appreciate you all hopping on today and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. So thank you all for watching. Be sure to hit that like button if you are watching this, and I will be back here tomorrow. Two more days of National Public Health Week. So look forward to seeing you all tomorrow, 6 p.m. Eastern. Have a good night, everyone.